Welcome back to the program. As the president said about determining policy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, the specter of Vietnam was ever present. The president even referenced it in a speech on Tuesday night. Books about Vietnam have been flying off the shelves in Washington. Arguably, the long national nightmare still haunts American policymakers. The question is, 34 years after the fall of Vietnam, do we yet really understand what happened? What were the military and political mistakes, and yes, even some of the successes? And what are the real as opposed to the perceived lessons from that nightmare? We're going to talk about this aspect of history, some call revisionist history, about Vietnam, with my guest Lewis Sorley. He's a third-generation graduate of West Point. He holds a doctorate from Johns Hopkins University. He served in the U.S. Army on staff at the Pentagon, and later as a senior civilian official of the CIA. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his new book, A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. Lewis Sorley, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
I want to begin with the central premise of your book, which is that there were really two separate wars in Vietnam. There was the war that was fought through the Tet Offensive in 1967-68, and a very different war that took place between 1968 and 1972. When we think of Vietnam, we tend to think of it as one war. We tend to think of it in its totality. Talk about your view of what transpired.
General Westmoreland decided to fight a war of attrition. He commanded in Vietnam from 1964 to 1968, commanded U.S. forces, that is. And in a war of attrition, the measure of merit is body count. So his premise was that if he killed enough of the enemy, they'd lose heart and give up and cease their aggression against South Vietnam. And he did indeed kill an enormous number of enemy, but that didn't bring about the postulated outcome. Instead, the North Vietnamese, heedless of the casualties they were taking, just sent more and more replacements down. And in the meantime, General Westmoreland was largely ignoring two other crucially important factors. One was to upgrade South Vietnam's armed forces so they could eventually take over responsibility for their country's security. And the other, even more important, was to root out the communists' covert infrastructure that they had established in the rural hamlets and villages of South Vietnam, where they were using terror and coercion to keep the populace under their control. And the big battles out in the deep jungle were having no effect on that whatsoever. So it wasn't until after the famous Tet Offensive of early 1968 that we changed commanders there. General Abrams had spent a year as deputy waiting his turn to take command. He had a wholly different conception of the nature of the war. Yes, he understood you had to continue the combat operations, although he changed them very greatly from the large sweeps that I have described. And he understood the necessity for upgrading the South Vietnamese and for getting rid of that enemy infrastructure. He and Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker, another great American public servant, and William Colby, who came out to run our support for the pacification program, used to talk about one war. And they said, if you don't fight one war, meaning a war on all the important fronts, the ones I've described, then you cannot succeed. So that was the new approach, which proved far more availing.
But wasn't this also a period when we kept hearing that, you know, peace was at hand, there was light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, these were the phrases of the time that proved to be less than accurate when one looks at how the situation ended.
They were the phrases of the early period. They were the phrases used by Lyndon Johnson, by Robert McNamara, by William C. Westmoreland. They were not the phrases of the latter period. You cannot find any such predictions or quotations from Ellsworth Bunker when Abrams was there, or from Abrams, or from Colby. They all understood that it was a long, tough battle, but it was one that, if you approached in the proper way, you had a good chance of succeeding. And another interesting contrast between the two periods is General Westmoreland's reaction to any problem in the earlier period was to ask for more troops. And for a long time, he got them, so that by the time he had completed his tenure there, we were well over 500,000 troops in Southeast Asia. During General Abrams' period, the later years, we progressively withdrew those forces. In fact, this may be an anomaly of history. It's the only case I know about where the commander of an expeditionary force sent his army home before himself.
Mm-hmm. talk a little bit about the pacification program under Colby, because it was an area of great controversy at the time, and certainly many in America argued at the time that it wasn't working, that it was one of the failures of what was going on over there.
Well, they were uninformed or misinformed, or in some cases, I'm sorry to say that this is the case, they were deliberately misrepresenting the situation because they desired to bring about an end of American involvement in the war, or in some cases to avoid their own involvement. And, you know, so there are different motives at work here. But the fact is that pacification was a lot of different things, the most important, because if you don't get this, then you can't do the other things, was security for the people of South Vietnam. I mentioned that body count was a measure of merit under Westmoreland. Under Abrams, the measure of merit was population secured. He said over and over again, body count doesn't have much to do with the outcome of this war. And on one occasion, when he was speaking to the assembled American ambassadors from the region, he said, in the whole sweep of this war, the battles don't really mean very much. That's the opposite extreme from General Westmoreland's focus on killing the enemy. In the pacification program, a number of the things that went together were increased security for the people. That had to come first. There was a saying in Vietnam that some people will say security is 10% of pacification. Some people will say it's 90% of pacification, but they will all agree that it's the first 10% or the first 90%, because if you can't do pacification with an NVA division walking through the backyard. So that was the first thing. But many other things were important. Intelligence was extremely important, and then the people won't give you intelligence until they feel secure that the enemy won't be able to exact retribution against them for doing that. The economy was extremely important. So-called miracle rice was introduced, which increased crop yields 2 and 3 times. The roads to the to and from market were kept open. President Chu was viewed by Colby and by Abrams as Vietnam's number one pacification officer. He went all across the country preaching the importance of this, and they took a training center at Vung Tau and made it a place where village and local officials would be brought for training. And in 1 year, they ran almost three-quarters of those officials in the whole country through courses there. And President Chu went to every one of them, and he said to these village chiefs and province and hamlet chiefs, "You've got to be like a little president in your hamlet, your village, and you've got to serve the needs of the people." And then these people, these low-level officials, could go back home and have the cachet of being able to say, "Well, as President Chu said to me at Vung Tau," and so on. So it was a whole complex of things, and you said that this was a controversial program, and I'm sure you're right about that, but I believe that one of the major reasons that it was controversial was most people did not know about many of the components of it, such as the ones that I've been describing, and we have to say that that's because those were underreported or maybe even ignored by much of the media. And you can understand that, too. I mean, it's a war. So what do you report in war? You report fighting and killing. And it's hard to report on these undramatic things like getting better rice in there or opening up the farm-to-market roads.
One could argue that certainly the war was conducted much better after Abrams took over. But it's also possible to argue that it was too late by that point, given what had preceded it.
Well, of course, we know from the outcome that it was too late. I mean, it turned out to be too late, but it didn't have to. In a better war, I am so bold as to argue there came a point at which the war was won. I say the fighting wasn't over, but the war was won. And the reason it was won was that we had helped the South Vietnamese to achieve the capability, so long as we kept our commitments to them, a crucial conditional, to maintain their freedom and independence of action. And indeed they had. They were getting increasingly better at that. In the earlier period, for example, General Westmoreland had pretty much hogged all the best weaponry and all the best combat multipliers for American forces, so that the South Vietnamese in the earlier years were consistently outgunned by the enemy. The enemy was given the great AK-47 by their communist backers, and the South Vietnamese were making do with cast-off World War II U.S. weapons like carbines and M1 rifles. When Abrams took command, he said, first priority for the M16 now goes to the South Vietnamese, and by the way, it goes to the territorial forces, which were the ones that were protecting their home, villages, their people, their families, their ancestral grave sites, and things that mattered to them most of all. And so they got better training, they got better weapons, and things got much better. But what happened in the end? How come this, you know, didn't have a better outcome? And this is the crucial thing to know about the war in Vietnam. I suggest, if we're talking about any lessons learned from there, that might have future applicability now or some other time. The outcome didn't have to be as it was, but the Congress of the United States was the instrument of our abandonment of the South Vietnamese. You cannot say it in any nicer way than that. We had committed ourselves, the President had committed the United States to the South Vietnamese, that after the Paris Accords were signed in January of 1973, if the North Vietnamese violated the provisions of that truce and renewed aggression against the South, that we would reintroduce combat power to punish that. And we're talking here primarily about B-52 bombers. And secondly, that if there was renewed fighting, we'd replace on a one-for-one basis their loss of major combat systems. We're talking artillery pieces, tanks, aircraft, things like that, which was provided for in the Paris Accords. And thirdly, that we would maintain a robust level of financial support for them for the foreseeable future. And when it came to the crunch, we defaulted on all three of those commitments, and the Congress was the one who did it. And at that point, the die was cast. I have a friend named Thomas Polgar, who was the last CIA chief of station in Saigon. And one of his last messages says, I'm paraphrasing, but this is very close. He said, outcome no longer in doubt. South Vietnam cannot continue without support from us so long as the North Vietnamese continue to get robust support from their communist backers. And that's what happened.
The other issue is that even though the war that was being conducted by Abrams was certainly a better war, the argument is that we had lost sight of what the mission was for the war itself, and the question really was whether or not we should have even been engaged in this war.
Well, you've raised two very different and disparate things in the same sentence. You can certainly argue that we should not have been engaged in that war in the first place. But if you are going to argue that, you've got to have some appreciation, and I'm sure you do, of the international and historical context in which the decision to do that was made. And that is that it was the height of the Cold War, and the outlook on the part of successive administrations, not just one party and not just one president, was that it was important to resist the advance of communism to new areas of the world, because that was part of the international competition between the free world and the communist world.
Right, but from the perspective of history right now, when we look back on the Cold War and we look back on all that we know about what was going on in the former Soviet Union, it accentuates the fact that the war was a mistake.
Well, I can't agree with that, because as you've heard me say already, I believe the war was successfully completed until the Congress of the United States, or the certain elements, you know, of it, decided to abandon the South Vietnamese. And by that time, all we were giving them was money. So, you know, Americans were out of there. Our prisoners had been recovered. They were doing the fighting and dying. And we said, oh, sorry, we can't give you any more money, even though, you know, we spent 10 years supporting you and so on. But let us leave that aside. The other issue that you raised was whether the war could or would have been won, was won. That's a different issue, I suggest, by a large measure, than whether we should have been involved in the first place. And the fact is, you suggested that we didn't know what we were there for, or that people lost track of that. I want to tell you that as a soldier who fought there, I was never in any doubt as to why we were there. And I don't think there were too many who would doubt that even today.
Talk about
Yes, we were there because our government thought it was in America's interest to be there, and the objective sought then was to maintain South Vietnam's capacity to sustain itself as an independent and free nation, and not to be subjugated, as it ultimately was, by aggression from the North. Now, here's a thing that might be of interest to you. After the war was over, and a few years after it was over, and the dust had settled a little bit, the Veterans Administration decided to have some polling done, and they didn't do it themselves. They got one of the major polling companies to do this, and they went around and asked the Vietnam veterans how they felt about it. And they said that they were proud of their service there, and here, this will, I think, is quite incredible. Two-thirds of them said they would serve again, even knowing the outcome of the war. Now, that to me is quite remarkable. So I don't think that the average person who served was, first of all, in any doubt as to why we were there.
Do you believe, let me ask you a question, do you believe that if that same poll had been done with those same veterans immediately after they came back from Vietnam, the results would have been the same?
Well, of course, I don't know that, and neither do you. But I will tell you, the reception that veterans received when they came back to the United States was not a very good one. And I'm glad to say is in stark contrast to what we're seeing when our veterans are returning today. But one big difference between the Vietnam era and now that's of interest probably to you and me both in that context is that we had a draft in the Vietnam era, and we have an all-volunteer force now. And so many people think that the people who fought the war in Vietnam were a bunch of draftees and that they may have gone there unwillingly and so on. And the fact is that two-thirds of the people who served in the Vietnam era were volunteers. Two-thirds were volunteers. One-third were drafted. And now we've got, of course, 100% volunteers. But there's another interesting contrast with the so-called Greatest Generation. During World War II, the statistics were just the opposite. Two-thirds of the people who fought World War II were drafted. One-third volunteered.
But wars are, by their very nature, political instruments, and it is the determination of the country and the determination of Congress by virtue of the Constitution to determine the extent to which U.S. forces are committed in war.
No one can argue with that. The Congress of the United States had an absolute right to abandon the South Vietnamese and to cast away all the sacrifices American soldiers and other armed services people had made. They had a right to do that. I think they were desperately wrong in doing that, but certainly we understand that in our country the politicians rule.
If the outcome had been different with respect to Congress, if the money had been allocated, how do you think it would have turned out?
Well, I think it would have turned out much differently than it did, and historians are reluctant to say what might have been or what if, but some of them found out that they can make some money doing that now, so there's less reluctance than there once was. The probably the best indicator would be what we now call the Easter Offensive of 1972.
Mm-hmm.
The North Vietnamese came across the demilitarized zone with the equivalent of about 20 divisions in an all-out conventional war-type invasion of the South at about the time of Easter 1972. And by that time, virtually all the American ground forces had been withdrawn. General Abrams was still there. What he's got left to help the Vietnamese with is air power and naval gunfire almost exclusively. And it was a desperate battle that went on for months, but the South Vietnamese bravely held and turned back the invasion, and the North Vietnamese were so badly hurt that it was 3 years before they could mount another major offensive. Now, after that, the critics, of whom there were always plenty, said, well, the South Vietnamese couldn't have hacked it without the American air power. General Abrams was having none of that. He said, yes, American air power was important to their defense, but he said if the Vietnamese had not, if the South Vietnamese had not stood and fought, 10 times the air power could not have turned that battle. That's part of a larger sort of conception that I think we should mention here. People said, well, we've been there a long time, we need to withdraw and so on, and they've got to hack it on their own and things like that. Well, okay, that's a viewpoint, but at the same time, we had about 50,000 Americans in Korea, I don't know, 10 years, let's say 15 years after the Korean War ended, and we had about 300,000 Americans in Western Europe, a longer time than that after World War II had ended, and nobody complained that they were there because the West Europeans couldn't hack it militarily without our help, or the South Koreans the same. We were in all those places because it was the conception of our government that it was in American interest to be there.
And perhaps it reached the point where it no longer was in the American interest to be in Vietnam.
Well, I'm afraid I can't see that, but obviously the majority of the Congress of the United States agreed with you.
Talk a little bit about the incursions into Cambodia during this period.
Well, you know, I'm sure, that for most of the war, we had imposed on ourselves, self-imposed, limitations against anything crossing the borders of South Vietnam into the western reaches of where Laos and Cambodia abutted Vietnam, and where the famous Ho Chi Minh Trail snaked down from North Vietnam and was the primary means by which they introduced both materiel and manpower into the south. And General Westmoreland was especially fighting the kind of war I told you about, was just desperate to get across there and get at those forces. But he was never allowed to do so. And in fact, the only time that we did that in any major way was in 1970, when a new president, now Lyndon Johnson having been supplanted by Richard Nixon, a new president says, okay, we're going to have a raid into Cambodia, and the purpose is going to be to scarf up all the wherewithal that the enemy has prepositioned there, and so he allowed that, and both South Vietnamese and American forces did that. The president badly undercut it, because when he announced it, he said, well, this is only going to be for 60 days, and it's only going to be for I think it was 30 kilometers depth. Well, that was very helpful to the enemy to know that. They hauled as much of their wherewithal as they could back beyond the limits that he had prescribed, and sort of waited it out. So it was very helpful in this respect. A lot of the wherewithal was scarfed up, and so that, you could say, bought some more time for what we were then calling Vietnamization, which was the progressive withdrawal of U.S. forces and progressive turning over of combat responsibilities to the South Vietnamese. The next year, 1971, by then, the Congress had voted the American forces out of any cross-border operations, statutorily prohibited that, and so there was a raid into Laos that was conducted only by the South Vietnamese. We were allowed to support them with aircraft, but nobody on the ground, and that was a very tough and bloody battle, which scarfed up a lot of enemy wherewithal also, and inflicted a lot of casualties on them, but at a high cost to the South Vietnamese as well. So those are the only two times that we were allowed to do anything out of South Vietnam itself. And many people feel that if, in the earlier period in particular, we'd been allowed to go across the borders into Laos and cut, if you will, blockade the Ho Chi Minh Trail, that the enemy's forces in the south could have been starved out.
If we were making so much progress in the early 70s, why was there not more leverage, more pressure for the North Vietnamese in the context of the Paris negotiations?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and it maybe even be the central question. And I don't know that there's a definitive answer to that, but some of the pieces of it might include these. The North Vietnamese have boasted that they were not going to win the war in Vietnam, that they were going to win it in Washington, and that they could, in effect, outlast us, because public opinion would wane and the support for the war would wane. And you have to say, it pretty much turned out that way. And as I'm sure you know, there were groups in the United States who were actively abetting that. So the North Vietnamese were shrewd politically, and that worked pretty well. In the South, they had shown from the beginning that the level of casualties just seemed to make no difference to them, and then they took terrible, terrible casualties. We have agonized for years over some 2,500 missing in action in the war. The Vietnamese have maybe 300,000 missing in action from the war, the North Vietnamese, I mean to say. So their willingness to sacrifice was horrifying to me, but you have to say impressive at the same time. The third thing was, even though they took enormous casualties, they had the ability to limit those to some degree, because when they wanted to do so, they could pull their forces back across those borders, western borders of South Vietnam, into Laos and Cambodia, and except for the two cases I've described, we were not allowed to go after them there, and so they could go back and they could refit and retrain and so on. I think the 9th VC Division got creamed about five times during the course of the war, and they'd go back with what remnants they had left and build it back up again, and then here it'd come again.
Talk about the final days of American troops in Vietnam.
The progressive withdrawal of American forces began in July and August of 1969, which was just a few months after Richard Nixon had become president in January of that year. The first increment was 25,000 troops, and then at the end of 1969, October, November, December, they took out another 40,500. And as I just mentioned earlier, we had well over 500,000 forces there at the high watermark. They were brought out progressively in 14 increments. The last ones, almost the last ones, were at about the time of that Easter offensive that we were talking about. And then when the Paris Accords were signed in January of 1973, they said that by a date in March, all the U.S. forces had to be withdrawn, and they were. The only thing left was a normal kind of military attaché operation. So at that point, we're out of there. The agreement was terribly flawed from the South Vietnamese viewpoint, because the North Vietnamese were not obliged to take their forces out of South Vietnam, the ones that were there as invaders. So almost immediately after the Paris Accords, within 48 hours, let's say, the fighting resumed. The North Vietnamese were already there, as I've said. They apparently never had any intention of ceasing their efforts to take over the South militarily. And so then, there are 2 years of hard fighting there, during which we're progressively with reducing our support, monetary support now, and logistical support. As I said, that's all we were obliged to give them then, and we even defaulted on that. So by the early days of, well, by the very late days of 1974, early days of 1975, the pinch is really on. They're just extremely sad stories of even washing bandages to use them again and so on. And if you compare the wherewithal that they had then to what American forces had, 50 rounds for an artillery piece per day, now reduced to two or things like that, you can see that they were greatly disadvantaged. The outcome was that when the final offensive was mounted by the North Vietnamese early in 1975, pretty much everywhere things went to pieces in very rapidly. And this was partly because of the logistical deficiencies, but I think even more because they could see that the outcome was inevitable. I mentioned Tom Polgar's cable, uh-huh. Outcome no longer in doubt, and I'm sure that was clear to all the Vietnamese. Then of course, we have to make a desperate effort to withdraw those that we felt were at risk. In the final days of April 1975, we withdrew all the Americans and 130,000 Vietnamese, and many, many more Vietnamese. No one knows for sure how many, because a lot were lost at sea, but perhaps a million others became so-called boat people, preferring to risk their lives at sea and try to find a new home elsewhere rather than live under the communists who had come to supposedly liberate them. And the only good thing about that is we now have in the United States perhaps a million or more Vietnamese Americans who have added a great deal to our country.
Of course, if we look at it from the perspective of history, one can argue that we did indeed do the right thing by pulling out when we did, when we look at Vietnam today.
Well, I can't quite see that viewpoint. There are a lot of people there still living under a highly repressive regime, when it's quite clear that they would prefer to have a the freedom that they enjoyed before. But I refer you to some very interesting writings by a New York Times reporter named Seth Meidens. He reports on Vietnam Today, and much of what he writes is very interesting in terms of what you and I have been discussing. For example, he writes that the former South Vietnamese are now producing two-thirds of the GNP of that country, even though they represent less than 50% of the populace. I haven't been back to Vietnam since the war. I've had opportunities, but it's still too sad for me. I don't can't quite bring myself to do that. But it is clear that there are wonderful things going on where that's been permitted. Another thing, however, and Mr. Meidens has described this as well, is that the expatriate Vietnamese, not just those in America, but those in Canada, in Australia, in France, where the large numbers do, are sending back every year billions of dollars to their families that remain behind there, and that's a major boost to their economy.
Of course, the other aspect of it is that the original mission of the war, it's the role that it played within the context of the Cold War, has a different perspective from where we sit today as well.
Well, that's of course true, but if we could look ahead and see how history would play out, we'd be able to be a lot smarter about a lot of things. One of the things that some people have argued, and I'm not really an advocate of this particularly, but I can see why they would say so, is that even though the outcome in South Vietnam was inevitable, ultimately unsuccessful, the fact that the Allied forces for about a decade sought to keep South Vietnam free gave other regional governments an opportunity to strengthen themselves, so that when the end came, the only two other remember the domino theory, the only other two dominoes that fell were Laos and Cambodia, and the other nations in the region, such as Thailand and Indonesia and so on, had strengthened themselves to the extent that the communist domination did not go any further than just those Southeast Asian countries. There was, in the time of the Tet Offensive of 1968, when there was a lot of talk about the domino theory, there was a bitter joke that said that the Tet Offensive proved the domino theory, even though only one domino fell, and that domino was Lyndon Johnson.
What did the military learn from Vietnam?
Well, I suppose you could say they learned a number of things. One of the things maybe that they relearned was techniques of fighting a counterinsurgency type warfare. That we had a lot of experience in that much earlier. You mentioned that I'm a third generation West Pointer. My grandfather was in the Spanish-American War and in the very tail end of the Indian Wars, and then he went to the Philippines, where we helped put down the insurrection there. We had considerable experience in counterinsurgency, therefore, in things like the Indian Wars and in the Philippines and so on. And then the Marines had considerable in Latin America as during the 30s and the 20s and so on. We remembered or relearned, I guess, some of the things that we need to know to do that effectively, although not until General Abrams came on the scene was that applied in any effective way. I think we learned something we probably already knew, but extremely important, and I'd say important today as well, that if you don't have widespread backing for what you're trying to do, because these things take time, you can't go in and do the kinds of things we've been talking about in a short period of time. If you don't have widespread backing, then you're probably going to see the effects of what you've done undermined by not staying the course.
Given that we have all of this experience that you talk about with counterinsurgency, that we understand that the military understands how counterinsurgency is supposed to work, why do we always get it wrong at the beginning of wars, whether it's Vietnam and the story you talk about in A Better War, or even what we saw in Iraq and how wrong we got it in the beginning before General Petraeus came in?
Well, that's a great question. I wish I had an answer to that. You are absolutely right. The same pattern was repeated in Iraq that we have been discussing in Vietnam. And I think I'm going to have to say that it's not an institutional thing as much as it is an individual thing. The Army had the background and experience we've just discussed. General Westmoreland essentially was either oblivious to that or ignored that and tried to fight the kind of war of attrition that we've spoken about. And then General Abrams comes in. Nothing else changes. Just Westmoreland goes away and Abrams comes, and he has a wholly different understanding of the nature of the war and consequently of how it needs to be prosecuted. Apparently that same pattern was followed in Iraq. The initial commanders there wanted to fight it the way Westmoreland did, you know, roar in there with a lot of military force. And by the way, keep that force, sequestered in base camps and so on and make forays from there. And then General Petraeus comes in and he understands every bit as well as General Abrams did that a different way will be more effective. And by the way, it's a way that depends less on force than it does on other things. When General Petraeus was back in the United States for a relatively brief time and commanding at Fort Leavenworth, he led the efforts to write a new counterinsurgency manual which was adopted by the Army and the Marine Corps jointly. And he had a conference out there of about 40 people that were going to help him write this thing. And he invited me to come out there and talk. And he said, you and I are going to be the two keynote speakers. You're going to look to the past and I'm going to look to the future. And we spent two or three days out there doing just that. And the manual that he produced is a manual that General Abrams would have been very happy to put his name on as well.
Lewis Sorley, the book is A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. It's just out in paperback from Harcourt. Lewis, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for a very interesting conversation.
Thank you.